And now, coming up, reverse outsourcing. Indian companies bringing white-collar American workers to India to train them and then return them to work for Indian companies in the U.S. But first, an estimated 53 million people are about to hit the road for the holidays. And a new study shows that the ones traveling in smaller cars are twice as likely to have fatal accidents as people in midsize and larger cars. Automakers have been turning out smaller cars to cash in on consumers looking for better gas mileage and a cheaper sticker price, not to mention ease in parking. Royal Ford, yes, that is his real name, writes about the auto industry for the Boston Globe. He has more on today's study. Royal, first of all, what exactly is a mini car?
Basically below about 2,500 pounds. You're looking at Toyota Yaris, Honda Fit, that size car.
Are these the Mini Coopers?
Mini Cooper's actually a little bit heavier, but it was included in this particular study.
And what's the risk?
The risk mostly is side impact, I would say, more than anything else. That's where most of the cars had problems, other than the Nissan Versa. The Toyota Yaris, for instance, they make side airbags, but you have to buy them if you want them. So the Yaris pretty much failed the test without them, did very well in the test with them. But it's not just the airbags, there's also structural integrity. Honda Fit, for instance, did very well in the side impact because its side rigidity was good. Mm-hmm. The Hyundai Accent, even with airbags, the side rigidity was not that good, so they didn't do as well.
Well, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety did the test. They're a nonprofit funded by the insurance industry. They tested 8 of these mini car models. Is part of the reason that smaller cars have the higher fatality because it's a smaller car colliding with a larger car and a smaller car loses?
Yeah, that's, it's simple physics. I mean, even a small car colliding with another small car is going to do worse than a small car colliding with a large car. You know, the head of the institute told me, he said, you have to be afraid of everything.
Well,
if you're driving a small car.
But you report also that Honda, Nissan, Toyota, GM have all come out with these new or redesigned subcompacts. Sales of small cars are through the roof. According to Business Week, low-priced small cars sit on dealer lots about half the time as larger vehicles. Well, first of all, the consumers want them because they're more fuel-efficient, are they?
Well, they're definitely more fuel-efficient. And what's interesting is a lot of them get 34, 35 miles per gallon, which is not much less than your hybrids, which have come with a $7,000 premium.
Well, what do you think is going to be the result of this study? Someone in our office said it feels a little like nuclear disarmament right now. I mean, people aren't going to want to give up their bigger cars for the smaller cars until there are less bigger cars on the road, given this report about fatalities in smaller cars.
I think the major effect is going to be you're going to see side airbags mandated in all cars by 2010.
And why is it that that sellers don't do that now? Is it just the cost?
They want to make money. I mean, on a small car, you have to cut costs to make money, and that's what they do.
Right. But you also write that it's the consumers, if they're given a choice between a stereo and a side airbag, often choose the stereo.
That's a sad fact. And some companies, which I call criminal, often link safety equipment to sunroofs, stereo. If you want ABS, for instance, if you want airbags, you have to buy the sunroof. I say that's criminal.
Royal Ford talking to us about a new study today from a nonprofit group funded by the automobile insurance industry that showed that mini cars are more than twice as likely to be involved in fatal accidents than larger cars. And Royal, we know you're hearing from consumers.
I'm hearing from consumers, and oddly enough, it's people think that I'm trying to sell SUVs and promote them, and I'm not. The purpose of the story is to say if you buy a small car, you need to be aware that whether your fault or not, there's a risk. If you get hit by any size car, you're more likely to be killed. And, that's just a fact. And this also said the safest car to buy now is the Nissan Versa.
With the side airbags.
With the side airbags. But they're standard, so you don't have a choice.
Right. Royal Ford, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, you've heard of outsourcing, the shipping of American jobs overseas. A new trend seems to be emerging. It's called reverse outsourcing. It's the shipping of American white-collar workers overseas, hired by foreign companies in many of the same countries that took the outsourced jobs. And once again, as in outsourcing, Indian firms are leading the way. Some train their American workers here, but one company, Infosys, India's second-largest computer services company, recruits on American college campuses and sends young trainees called Infosians to an employee complex in Mysore, India that is so deluxe they call it Club Med. Well, joining us first on the line is Infosys Infosian David Craig, who graduated last year from the University of Arizona, where he was recruited. He's just finished the first phase of training in India, and he joins us from there. David, welcome.
Thank you.
And what does it mean? You are an Infosian, we understand. What does that mean?
Well, it means I'm a part of the Infosys family, and it's a big group of people that all help each other out here in India. And then by sending us back, they hope to benefit from having an American face
right
in North America instead of an Indian face.
So you are trained there to come back here ultimately?
Right, yes.
What kind of training are you having?
Well, the first 4 months, we just wrapped that up. That involved technical training in programming and in various aspects of how a software application is developed.
How are you paid? Are you paid on the Indian salary scale or an American one?
In India, we're paid in the Indian salary scale in rupees. It's not quite like we get paid in the United States, but it's pretty comparable.
You're young. We said you were recruited right out of college by an Indian company. What was your thinking process? I mean, you know, to pick up stakes and to move to India. Did you worry about its impact on your career, on your life, on your family?
Well, I was pretty much scared to death, actually, when I took the job. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But my main concern right off the bat was mostly family and being that far away from them for this long of a period of time, which is going to be 6 months when we're done with all of our training. I wasn't too worried about my career after this move, because I think that it's a great experience for a person coming right out of college to get just valuable, just global work experience to empower them to work in a global team in a changing business environment right now. It's becoming more global because you've got a lot more companies outsourcing to India, and you've got Infosys, which is outsourcing to the United States. And I think that this experience, training in teams, working with people from different cultures, different countries, it's just a great experience.
Well, what do you think about, you know, some of the criticism of outsourcing or, you know, and reverse outsourcing? First of all, from Indians, I mean, you know, you might be taking someone else's job. And then that IT companies here in the U.S. are losing you.
Okay, yeah. Well, I did think about that before I took the job. And I thought about it long and hard, and it was a tough decision, but I didn't see it as actually taking jobs away from people. I saw it as stimulating the Indian economy as well as the American economy.
But it's for an Indian company, and, you know, an American company loses you as a resource.
Right. And I think that Infosys has seen that as an issue, and that's how they came up with the idea that they should have a North American-based consulting company.
Yeah. Well, meantime, I understand you're actually going to be staying there for at least a while to work for the Infosys banking unit in Bangalore?
Yes, we're going to train with a project team that we'll be working with once we get back to the U.S.
And in the meantime, how, you know, what about the rest of this experience of being in India? Do you get to go outside of the, what's it called, the Club Med, the center there? Do you get to see a lot of Indian culture?
I have. I've seen a little bit of it. I've seen a lot of Mysore, and I've traveled out of Mysore a few times. And it's completely different than what I expected. I mean, I was expecting people to be riding elephants and camels all over the place, and that's not the case. It is very crowded, and there are a lot of signs of poverty around, which sometimes gets to me. Mm. But I've found ways to just deal with it and say that's just the way that Indian culture is right now, and just kind of accept it as that. But it's been fun. A lot of people were very helpful in the city. And Infosys has done a great job of kind of taking us around on tours of the city. So it was a nice way to kind of start this living in India part of our lives.
Quite an eye-opening experience for, what, 23-year-old are you now?
Yeah, 23. Yeah.
Well, David, thanks for talking to us about it.
You're welcome.
David Craig, he was hired straight out of college by the Indian computer company Infosys to train in India, where he was just speaking to us. He says he'll return to the U.S. next year to work for them here. Well, we turn now to Catherine Mann, professor of international economics and finance at Brandeis University. And Professor Mann, an Indian computer firm where jobs were once outsourced to Indians is now hiring Americans to go to India. How would you characterize this trend?
Well, I think it's a trend that makes a lot of sense from a business perspective for Infosys.
Because?
Well, because they have a very big presence in the U.S. marketplace. That's where they get most of their revenue from. And increasingly, what needs to happen with a consulting type of environment is you need to be able to combine tacit knowledge of how the U.S. economy works with specialized skills, so-called codified skills, which is something that you could train anybody to do. So what they're doing with David in this case is they are teaching him the codified skills in India, the programming skills and that sort of thing, but they are sort of embodying that in a U.S. person who has a lot of tacit knowledge about how the U.S. market works. He may not even know he has that knowledge, but he does.
It's just cultural. Well, we heard David say, though, that the area where he's being trained masks the poverty in the city beyond, and he seems to be struck by the poverty in India. And, you know, that begs the question, isn't he taking a job that could have been taken by an Indian who could have been taught some of the cultural ways of America?
Well, I think there are two issues that are happening here. The biggest point that I think needs to be addressed in the case of a company like Infosys or Wipro or really any company like that in a developing country is why don't they spend more effort in creating products that are appropriate for their own marketplace? One of the things that I've learned in a dozen different developing countries is that the potential transformative power of these kinds of companies when they focus on their own economy is enormous. It's tremendous. It means jobs for, you know, many more people than just one company can produce because of how they take their products and get used throughout an economy. So I think the real question is, why doesn't Infosys focus a little bit more on producing products for their own country? And then, if they did that, then they would be hiring Indians who will have tacit knowledge of India and who will be trained.
Catherine Mann, professor of international economics and finance at Brandeis University. Tell you what, we'll take a quick break. Catherine, Professor Mann, will be back with us in a moment to tell us why she thinks traditional outsourcing has an upside, even though some American companies might go out of business and workers lose their jobs. Also, quick program note, later in the program, what's the biggest cash crop in the U.S.? One man who's done the numbers using federal records says it's marijuana. Much more ahead here and now. It's here and now, and we're talking about reverse outsourcing. This is Indians outsourcing a company such as Infosys that hire Americans to come and work for them in India, train with them, and then come back and work for them in the U.S. Back with us is Catherine Mann, professor of international economics and finance at Brandeis University. And Professor Mann, you were just saying how Infosys could have a bigger impact in India if it developed products, you know, for Indians concentrated on working there. David Craig, the Infosys trainee we just heard from, says that he thinks that the reverse outsourcing is good for the American economy. Why would that be?
Well, it's true. It is better for the American economy because he will come back and be able to help integrate the Infosys product package to U.S. companies. That product package, maybe it's technical, maybe it's some back office operations. In the end, that product package is cheaper. And they are productivity enhancing. Why? lots of other companies in many different sectors of the economy use them. And through that process, where they're using information technology in finance and telecommunications, in distribution like FedEx, even in areas like health management, all those products now become cheaper for everybody to use, and so all those other sectors are the ones that have the job creation.
But how might it hurt American companies? I'm thinking the Infosys promotional material that was sent to us says that this global talent program creates this multicultural outlook for the company. Now that the nature of our services has matured from traditional IT services such as maintenance to high-end services like engineering and consulting. So it sounds as if these Indian companies are changing. So what does that mean? Are they going to be, you know, taking away the role of some U.S. companies?
Well, I think what they are going to do is raise the competitive bar for U.S. companies. But I think it's important to go back to why David is in India, and that is because he has a combination of tacit knowledge of the domestic marketplace, which in this case is we're talking about the United States. What Infosys is doing is it's taking people who with all of that kind of tacit knowledge and then also adding in skills, specific skills, and being part of the Infosys family, which I think was a point that David made early in the interview, that he feels he is now part of the Infosys family. And I'm not sure too many people describe U.S. companies using the family word.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
But will he end up hurting American workers?
Some people say that competition is a good thing because it enhances the overall capability of the economy to produce goods and services at a price that people want to buy. But along the way, there is no question that businesses go bankrupt and workers lose their jobs. And that is both the upside and the downside of competition and globalization and information technology, all three of them together.
And, you know, outsourcing in general, it feels as if it was a huge headline, a much-discussed, debated story for a while, and then it seemed to go away. It's not in the headlines as much, but has it been reduced, the real idea of outsourcing, of sending jobs overseas?
Well, it was a big political issue, and I think it will be again. I think this is an issue where the heat on the bottom of the pot is rising. It's getting hotter, and the reason why is that many more jobs that we thought of as being service jobs, where you had to kind of be here in front of your client and producing things directly for your client, more of those jobs now can be divided up into kind of two different talents, one the tacit knowledge talent and one the codified skill talent. And it is people like David Craig who is embodying both. And to the extent that U.S. workers embody both, they will continue to have jobs. But people who have only codified skills, and programmers do fit into that category in some cases, those jobs are ones that are most at risk.
By the way, while we have you, what do you think are the most vulnerable jobs to outsourcing, traditional outsourcing?
Well, they are the ones that are codified skills. Those are the ones where you can either replace it with a computer or you can replace it with somebody who doesn't really need to know anything about the environment in which the product is being implemented. Something where, for example, people who are terrific at doing Excel spreadsheets, but you know, don't really ever look at a client or try to understand what's going on in an Excel spreadsheet, that's the kind of skill that would tend to be outsourced as well.
Mm. Catherine Mann, Professor of International Economics and Finance at Brandeis University. We've been talking about reverse outsourcing. This is Indian companies hiring Americans, young Americans, to come to India and be trained with certain skills and then work there for a while before sending them back to work in the U.S. at the Indian-owned companies and bring their cultural skills to the job as well. You don't seem, what am I hearing here? You don't seem that disturbed by this trend.
Well, I think, to begin with, I think the positive results of having U.S.-born students or workers go abroad and experience another country, I mean, that is just positive. There are no downsides to that whatsoever. The downsides to, you know, more narrowly, the downsides to reverse sourcing or international sourcing is that there are some people who have skills today who are going to find that those skills no longer guarantee them a job in the United States. This is not a new issue. It is an ongoing issue. And I think what the downside is that we have very little policy initiatives, very few policy initiatives in place to address the issue of how to ensure that the U.S. workplace and the U.S. workers are as competitive as some of these upcoming countries and companies are. That's what worries me, is that our policy framework and our policymakers don't seem to get it. The companies do, the workers do, the policymakers do not seem to get it.
In other words, a 23-year-old who's got a bright future may be headed off to India to train, where if a U.S. company was thinking, they might be training him.
Yeah.
Catherine Mann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Catherine Mann, professor of international economics and finance at Brandeis University on reverse outsourcing. Earlier, we spoke to a young man from Arizona working in Mysore, India. Well, this quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll speak with military analyst Anthony Cordesman about the war the U.S. might lose in Afghanistan and what Anthony feels the U.S. needs to do to win. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Now, what would you say if I asked you what the biggest cash crop in the U.S. was? Probably corn. In California, the biggest cash crop, maybe grapes. In Alabama, cotton. Well, a new report cites government statistics to support a claim that's been made by marijuana advocates for years, that cannabis is America's biggest cash crop. The report says the market value of pot in the U.S. exceeds $35 billion, far more than the top three legal cash crops, corn, soybeans, and hay, more than grapes, vegetables, and hay combined in California. John Getman produced the report, and he's hardly on the sidelines in the marijuana debate. He served as president and national director of the Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML, and he's a leading proponent in the push to legalize marijuana. He joins us now. And, John, more than $35 billion marijuana market. That just sounds unbelievable. How did you come up with that number?
The federal government has its own estimate of marijuana production, and they recently released figures indicating it was 22 million pounds. So I've taken that estimate and divided it up amongst the states based on the level of eradication activity, how many plants they've pulled out of the ground in this state or that state. Then I use some very conservative numbers on price, and that's where we get the $35.8 billion estimate from.
Well, we should say that federal anti-drug officials are withholding any comment on your numbers, except to say that the entire illegal drug business in the U.S. is $200 billion annually. So actually, marijuana might be a drop in that bucket at $35 billion, which is your calculation. But, you know, your report goes further. It says five states have marijuana crops worth over $1 billion. Top cash crop in 12 states? Which states?
The top 10 marijuana-producing states are California, Tennessee, Kentucky, Hawaii, Washington, North Carolina, Florida, Alabama, West Virginia, and Oregon.
So, you know, more than cotton in Alabama. We hear more than peanuts in Georgia. Why don't we see it, if that's the case? You'd think there'd be waving fields, like of grain.
First of all, let's remember that a crop like corn brings farmers some $200 per acre, maybe $250, depending on what the crop market is like that year. A single marijuana plant is worth as much as an acre of many of these other crops. Marijuana is grown in small plots, whether it's along fence lines in mountainous areas, and a considerable amount of marijuana is grown indoors now, in basements and attics and trailers, and even in warehouses in some parts of California.
We understand that there has been better eradication. In fact, the Boston Globe is reporting today that the frequent security stops that were started post 9/11 in the state of Vermont have not nabbed any terrorists, but have taken a surprising amount of marijuana. 3,000 pounds of marijuana have been seized, and there's a little bit of an uproar in Vermont about those security stops that have now turned into drug stops. But what about eradication? I mean, how is the U.S. doing on that level?
Well, it it's not doing very well. It's not a problem to find a large seizure or an impressive seizure for the police to get publicity from, but the bottom line is that they don't get more than 10% of the marijuana coming into this country or the marijuana grown in this country. And indeed, over the last 25 years of aggressive eradication programs, the government's own estimates have gone up tenfold, from 1,000 metric tons or 2.2 million pounds in 1981 to where now, again, it's 22 million pounds or 10,000 metric tons here in 2006.
Well, what do all these numbers mean to you? What do you think should happen?
There's a couple of obvious points here. One of them is that the current policies have utterly failed to control the marijuana market. The second point is that the high value of marijuana, often touted by police in their own publicity campaigns, encourages more and more people to go into the business. And the third and probably the most important point is that these high prices, rather than providing tax revenue to the public, instead, by encouraging all these people to go into the market, they encourage teenagers to sell marijuana to their friends. And that's the biggest source of marijuana in our schools, is teenagers selling it to each other. There's over a million teenagers who sell drugs in this country, according to federal surveys. If we want to have any progress in keeping kids from using marijuana, we need to get control over production, take them out of the market, and I think then with the added tax revenue, we can have much more successful discouragement campaigns.
Well, and so you're saying treat it like alcohol, have it be something that's sold above board, taxed, and take more kids out of the picture and put more controls on it.
Yes, and the important point to remember here is, of course, teenagers still drink. They still get their hands on alcohol, even though it's illegal for them.
Or cigarettes.
Cigarettes. But the difference would be we wouldn't have that extra profit incentive that makes things even worse. We don't have kids in high school today making money by selling tobacco and alcohol to each other. But we do have kids who find it easy to get their hands on marijuana and sell it to their friends, and they do so because there's so much money to be made.
Well, we did say that the federal officials, while not debating your numbers, do debate your conclusion. Tom Riley, who's with the White House Office of National Drug Control, told the LA Times that there are other countries that have huge cash crops, for instance, coca in Colombia, opium in Afghanistan, and they have devastated the countries. Do you worry that if marijuana is treated like the real cash crop that it is, that it will in turn corrode the country?
There's a big difference between marijuana and opium and marijuana and cocaine, and I think that's really the point that gets lost in Mr. Riley's comments. Marijuana has been used by adults responsibly in this country for over 30 years now. We already have a situation where most states refuse to enforce the federal marijuana laws. Most states basically have a slap on the wrist for people who are caught with marijuana. Now, we still have over 700,000 arrests per year. It takes up a lot of time and money from our criminal justice system. But many states have policies of no jail sentences for adult marijuana users or first-time offenders. Many more states have simple fines of $100 or so for marijuana use. The question really falls back on the federal government, which is, how do they expect these policies to succeed? They do not have any control over this market. And we need to come up with policies that give us more effective tools.
Are you in the school that thinks that marijuana is harmless? Because it'd be, you know, people know people who are addicted to marijuana.
Marijuana is not a harmless drug. People use it for its psychoactive properties, and right there it's pretty obvious that marijuana impairs or intoxicates people, so they shouldn't be driving under the influence. While there's technology to consume marijuana in a vaporless fashion, most people smoke it, and that smoke is bad for their lungs. But there's also a considerable amount of evidence that shows that marijuana has medical and beneficial properties to people who suffer from very serious illnesses. The fact is, marijuana is no more dangerous than alcohol or tobacco, and it shouldn't be treated more severely under the law for those reasons.
And finally, John Getman, what do you think would happen if somehow marijuana was removed from the economy of the U.S.?
I don't think it can be removed from the economy of the United States. They've been trying to do that for quite some time. I think in the long run, we could make a serious dent in the use of marijuana if it were not given this forbidden fruit status that it now has under federal law.
John Getman, public policy consultant and advocate for legalizing marijuana, who's also just produced a report that claims that cannabis is the biggest cash crop in the U.S., a $35 billion annual underground non-taxed business. John Getman, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And still to come today, after his mother dies, a filmmaker uncovers a story that turns his little home movie into a riveting documentary. That's still to come. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the holiday season is about to officially launch because we have our required story about the Nutcracker. And why not? Crowds love it. Ballet companies love it because it brings in the crowds and showcases new talent. This Nutcracker season, we asked a young dancer to send us an audio postcard. It's the day in the life of a Boston teen who's dancing two roles, as Fritz, Clara's jealous brother who breaks the Nutcracker, and a warrior mouse. Here's our diary.
Good morning. My name is Isaac Akiba, and I'm 18-year-old from Boston, Massachusetts, and I am a dancer. I train at the Boston Ballet School in the pre-professional division, and that's what I love to do, and this is a day in the life of me, pretty much. Today's gonna be like, get up, eat. Usually I have an egg or a bowl of yogurt and granola and brush my teeth, get dressed, go to the theater. There's a show at 1 o'clock, and I'm doing Fritz in that, in Act One. And then I have to be back at the theater for another show at 5:30, which I'm doing a mouse in the battle scene. So it's a pretty exciting day, pretty filled with a lot of things, but that's what my life is like, especially around Nutcracker. It's very busy. If I wasn't a dancer, I'd probably be sleeping till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, actually.
So right now I'm in the dressing room alone, and I think everyone's upstairs already. Well, I'm not here yet.
When I was a little kid, I don't remember going to see the Nutcracker at all. I don't think my parents ever took me. But even now, as an 18-year-old, it's still magical to me. You know, even though I'm there behind the scenes as Fritz, when I watch the Nutcracker, I try to separate my experiences backstage and, you know, not think about all the technical work behind the magic.
Okay, so right now I'm going up the back stairwells to stage right. Scenery's all out and the show's about to start, and I'm not that nervous anymore. I've done this plenty of times. Pretty excited for it. Pretty anxious to get on stage and do it and have fun. I'm really lucky that I have the ability to be a dancer. I try to work as hard as possible, trying to work smart, you know, and become the best dancer I can be. And I'm privileged because at the age of, you know, 16, I really knew what I wanted to do with my life. And some teenagers don't even know what they want to do with their life when they go into college. It just, I really hope that, you know, if I work hard enough, it'll take me all around the world. Right now, it is about 4:40, and me, my friend Alejandro, and my other friend Luca are walking back to the theater for the performance at 5:30, but we have to be there at 5 o'clock for a half an hour call. And in this show, I am doing the role as one of the six mice in the battle scene, which is after the party scene. It takes place after Drosselmeyer comes in, takes Clara, and he magically enlarges her house, and things start to come alive, and there's a whole battle between the mice and the Mice King and the Nutcracker. This role is actually incredibly fun. We have these big black costumes. We just basically look like a ball of black tulle, and we have a mouse head on, and it's a lot of fun.
I just love to dance, and I love the feeling of working hard and sweating and, you know, of your muscles burning and, you know, feeling that power.
It's just always been my dream to be in Boston Ballet. Hopefully that's where I'll end up. You know, I just gotta go out there and get it. I have to make it happen. But for right now, it's time to go to bed, time to get some rest. It's for tomorrow. So, that's about it. Good night.
A tired warrior mouse. Our audio diary from Isaac Akabee in The Nutcracker was produced by Here and Now Shannon Mullen. You're listening to Here and Now.
This happy-looking couple is Mike and Minna Block. They're not rich, they're not famous, and while they're not exactly ordinary, they're hardly people you'd think of making a documentary about.
That's Doug Block, a documentary filmmaker who often turned his camera on his family, his taciturn dad, a World War II vet who didn't talk much about his emotions, his sisters, and his favorite, his endlessly entertaining and outspoken mom. Suddenly, with no warning, Mom dies. 3 months later, Dad shocks the kids by getting remarried to the secretary he supposedly hadn't seen in 40 years. They put the family home at 51 Birch Street in Port Washington, Long Island, up for sale and make plans to move to Florida. And we start to think the film is an indictment of Dad. Then Doug Block finds the diaries of an angry 50s housewife, his mom. And before his lens, the true family story unfolds. Maybe his dad was silent to keep him from some painful secrets. The film is called 51 Birch Street, and Doug Block joins us now. Doug, welcome.
Oh, thanks.
You find your mother's diaries. What did you find out?
Well, I found out she was a person. You know, I found out she was a person with her own hopes and ambitions and dreams and frustrations, and certainly sexual frustrations. And it's very odd to think of your mother in that way, a still quite attractive woman in her mid-40s expressing all these desires and frustrations and hopes, and who was quite unhappy at the time that she started writing the diaries.
You agonize over whether or not you should read them. Let's listen to a scene where you reflect on that.
Reading Mom's diary confirms everything I'd feared. There's no mistaking it. Her unhappiness and frustration is palpable. And much of it is directed at Dad.
I don't remember her sounding like she was having a lot of fun too often. When we were younger, I know that Mom had to spend a lot of time with us alone, that Dad worked fairly long hours, and she was a traditional 50s housewife, and she had to discipline us or try. I think she was overwhelmed. I think she was frustrated. I know she loved us. I know, I don't worry about that part. But she should have been born later and not had 3 kids in 4 years.
How did you start thinking about your parents when, you know, these both the diaries and the interviews start revealing to you what they'd never talked to you about?
Well, you know, it wasn't that obvious to me. The process of making the film really started with wanting to get to know my father better. I mean, I came out about 2 weeks before the movers came, thinking it might be my last trip out there, and brought my camera with me really just to kind of capture the house for posterity one last time. Mm. And I threw a question or two to my father, and we just started talking. And he talked for the first time about my mother and about the marriage.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you do. There's now, after, you know, learning more about your mom and having compassion for her, you have this flowering of understanding for your dad. There's another scene from the film. You're driving with your dad, and this is, you know, he's married now to Kitty and moving, and you ask him, you know, a real gulp question about your mom, again, his wife of 54 years. Let's listen.
Do you miss her?
No, I can't say I miss her. I did the best I could with her and for her. But by the end of it, it was an association together that neither of us wanted to break, but it wasn't a loving association. It was a functioning association.
Doug Block, at that point, how did that hit you?
Well, I was stunned.
Yeah.
Of course I was. I mean, they fooled everybody. They fooled me. Everybody thought they had a very good, compatible marriage. So, you know, to hear that from my father just was shocking.
As we said, it started out with you and the viewer thinking, well, he's going to uncover something about his dad. His dad was having an affair. It turns out that it was your mom that was really struggling, really trying to find herself and did some searching outside of her marriage. And it seemed like you went through a few stages and finally came to one of what? Of what about your parents?
Frankly, to me, whether they had affairs or not, or the stuff that I uncovered was less important to me than the fact that, you know, my father and I were opening up to each other. I mean, it actually is remarkable the change that occurs in our relationship over the course of the 2 weeks that is kind of the present tense of the film.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is flashback, but it really covers primarily a two-week period. And that's often the stuff of theater and literature and, you know, Hollywood movies, these stories of families that, you know, where there's this kind of transformation of relationships. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why people have responded so strongly to the film, is you actually see our relationship undergo this kind of sea change in the course of the film.
There's a point in the film, though, where we do, in a funny way, get your mother's blessing as well. You ask your mom's best friend again, Natasha, if she thought your mom would be okay with not only with your reading the diary and then, you know, going even further than that. And let's listen to a little of that scene.
Oh, my God. That is the best question. Oh, God. Yes. I would have to say yes. It took all that writing and all that living and all that therapy for her to break it down for herself. And this goes a long way to a resolution in some way. Yeah. If Minna was sitting here right now, she would be delighted. What a relief for someone to really know us.
Doug Block, at the end, Natasha there, your mom's best friend, says that your mother would be thinking, what a relief for someone to really know us.
Hmm.
And that really hit me. It took it broader. Is this a film about a certain generation, do you think?
You know, it didn't start out to be. It started out to be just a film about my parents and getting at their marriage.
Oh.
You know, their marriage seemed to kind of play out against this whole backdrop of the late 50s and all the changes going on in the culture then and in the 60s, of course, as well, that they almost hit on every touchstone,
right?
Amazingly enough.
Well,
this very ordinary couple.
In the end, you ask yourself, when it comes to knowing about your parents, ignorance may be bliss, but is that your final conclusion?
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, that was when I was kind of hitting up against some walls.
Because it strikes me that even though it might have been painful and it seemed excruciating at times to read some of these diaries or to ask your father point blank a question, you know, a lot of people would give anything to know what happened.
Well, exactly. And, you know, that kept me going, you know, and I just sort of had this thought in mind that, you know, of what I wanted the reaction of the film to be. And it was a very simple one. It really just had more to do with wanting people to come out of the theater with this very simple desire to call their parents, to connect with their parents, to not have to have what happened to me happen to them, which is, you know, wait for one of them to die before you realize there were all sorts of questions and things that you wanted to say to them.
Doug Block's film is 51 Birch Street. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Doug, thank you and best to you.
Thank you, Rob.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.